This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. This is going to be a little shorter than normal. I had to run over to my mom and dad's house for a few minutes because I had been over at their house and I was uploading some things using their computer, my dad's books. I was uploading some stuff and I was uploading it to my account on Gmail, and I left it signed into my account as opposed to signed into my dad's account. So I had to go take care of that. And their house is on the way home, so this probably will be a little shorter than normal, but I had to take care of that today. It's been a good week. It is episode 220, and I've just had a lot of interesting conversations this week. My buddy on Wednesday is really in a time crunch with some things, so I wasn't able to get together with him. But this week, I got together with a buddy on Tuesday, and got together with a buddy this morning, and got together with my friends last Saturday. So, yeah, it's been fun this week. The writing is going well. I feel like I'm finally kind of settling in and finding a pace, and so I think I'll have some activities tonight that will take me away, but if it wasn't for those activities, I would actually hit 5,000 words this week. And with the previous week being the fable thus far, which is just the synopsis of the, you know, that's easier, I got 5,000 words the last time I was actually working on this for a week. So if I can keep at that 5,000 word pace, I can stay on schedule. My hope is that I will have these books mailed out before the end of September, which that's fairly mailed out to beta before the end of September. So that's a fairly ambitious schedule, but we'll see. The way things are falling and events are falling that are coming up, it would actually work well if I could do that. So probably what I'm going to do is wait to get the input. I'm going to turn on my little fan here and blow some hot air on myself because I haven't fixed my air conditioning yet. And so, I'm waiting to see how long it will be before I break down and go get my air conditioning fixed. It's like a test. Anyways, I have some events coming up, and it would just work well if by the end of September I had mailed out the beta copies of Amanda and the Cog-Shifting Imp. But we'll see. We'll see. And I just had a thought when I said that. Oh, I could tie that into the title. So anyways, I'm just thinking about it all the time now. But it's going to be, I think it's going to be fun. I hope, I think. You know, you just never know until you write it. It's one of the amazing things about creativity is you just never know until you write it. So, uh-oh, someone's got a trailer and they've got a flat tire and they're trying to make it home. So anyways, all goes well. That's fine. It's been a good week at work. Got the requisite things done that I needed to get done. And I think it was Tuesday or Monday as I was going home, I was listening to a TED Talk. And it was a good TED Talk. It was very, very interesting. And it goes along with something that's sort of been mulling around in my brain for the last several weeks. And I may have mentioned it already, and we'll get back to it after I finish kind of going over this TED Talk. The TED Talk was by a man named Andrew Solomon. Andrew Solomon has just recently released a new book I believe he's a Pulitzer Prize winner. Is it Pulitzer Prize? Something. A big award as a writer. Nonfiction, I think, is what he won his awards for. And he's written a book called Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. I'm tempted to read the book because it's getting some really good reviews. It is 900 pages, but apparently 200 pages of that is footnotes and annotations because of all the research that he did for this book. So, but it sounds like an interesting book. And it's basically what his TED Talk was about. So we'll talk about that a little bit and then talk more about what the book's about. Andrew Solomon is gay. He started off his talk by quoting a magazine article from Time Magazine and quoting the official dogma at the time, which was, as you can imagine, stridently anti-gay. And he noted that, and then he noted that here we are, Time Magazine 1966, that here we are in 2012 with a president who has come out in support of gay marriage. Noting that many things have changed, and specifically what has changed with being gay is that it has gone from being an illness to an identity. And it was within that context then that he started talking about another element of illness versus identity, and frankly quite a poignant element of this, and that is parents and children. Specifically, children who are born with an illness or a problem or an exceptional feature that then would cause them to be included in a certain identity. And it was pretty interesting because in his personal experience, he said there came a point where he went to a shoe store with his mother, and he said when we finished, he and his brother and his mother buying their shoes, the shoe store's person said, well, you can pick out a balloon to take home with you, and he said my brother wanted a red balloon, and I wanted a pink balloon, and my mother said, no, you really want a blue balloon because that's your favorite color. And I insisted that no, I really did want the pink balloon. He said, the fact that my favorite color is now blue, but I'm still gay, is evidence of both my mother's influence and its limits. Which was, that was cute. He did say that his mom would continually say to him growing up, the love that you have for your children is like no other feeling in the world, and until you have children, you don't know what it's like. And he said he came to a point in his life where that really grated on him. And at one point he actually told his mother, stop saying that, because that's not the road I'm going down. But he said about 20 years ago, he was asked by his editors at the New York Times Magazine to write a piece about deaf culture. And he said at that point, he had never heard of deaf culture. He said he knew that there were people who were deaf, that they had this disability, but he had no idea that a culture existed around that. He said, and so I went out into the deaf world. He said, I went to deaf clubs. He said, I saw performances of deaf theater and deaf poetry. He said, I went to the Miss Deaf America pageant in Nashville. He said, where people complained about that slurry Southern signing. Because it's a culture. And he said that he found that as he talked to people about deafness, that many had a response of, we don't lack hearing, we have a membership in a culture. And he said he also quickly ran into a tension that there is, because most deaf children are born to hearing parents. Most, just like most gay children are born to heterosexual parents. And he said the sorry, there's cars on the road and I'm on a narrower road and I'm just trying to make sure everybody was going in behind a tractor back there, and I wanted to make sure that they weren't going to try to bolt around that tractor while I was barreling for them. He said these parents were going through the same processes that a lot of parents were going through who have children who are born that are extraordinary. They are different from they are, from what they are. And parents typically go through a lot of the same things. Parents of autistic children, parents of exceptional children who are prodigies, even parents of children who commit terrible crimes. There's a process that these parents go through where they're trying to reconcile and trying to determine how they are going to act in this situation. And he said that led them, he said there's really, in his mind, two identities that children have to resolve. The first one is a vertical identity, that there are things you inherit from your parents and you get from your parents, such as your race, in some cases your ethnicity, your language, those types of things. You just inherit those and you acquire them vertically. He said, but there are other identities that only come about through horizontal peer relationships. And he said, what happens to children that are exceptional in some way, that are different, that are extraordinary in some way from their parents, is that what might start out as seeming like an aberration, as if the child continues in that path, at some point becomes an identity, and that child realizes that there are other people who have that same identity. And there's a dynamic here of how the parent then deals with whatever the child is dealing with. I was talking to a buddy this week just briefly, and he has had some experience with this because his youngest child was born with some genetic anomalies that has given him some characteristics of dwarfism. And he said, while it's true that kind of the first inclination you have as parents is that you just want to fix things, you just want to change things, he said, beyond that, just in thinking about the child, there is also, he said, this other piece of it where, and he specifically mentioned the mother, feels like there may be some reason that she's responsible for her child being there, that there's a guilt that comes along with that, which I would say that the flesh promotes along with that, to spur the parent to action. And one of the interesting conundrums of all of this, our friends certainly have done whatever they could do from a medical standpoint. One of the interesting conundrums that comes of all of this is that medical science is advancing to the point now where it can weigh in and influence the outcome of this child's identity. one of the things that he mentioned in his talk is the fact that many children who are born with hearing loss at this point are getting cochlear implants that allow them to function in a hearing world and even learn to speak fairly normally. And I was talking to another buddy this morning, and he said, yes, he has a friend who is connected to the deaf culture, and this is a raging debate within the deaf culture as to whether deaf parents who have a deaf child should get cochlear implants for their child or not. Because by doing that, they then disconnect them or make it harder for them to relate to the deaf culture. And it's a really interesting time, because beyond that, the other example that Andrew Solomon gave was that we are able to test earlier and earlier and earlier for Down syndrome. And if we can test earlier and earlier and earlier, that means parents will have more options as to whether or not they wish to abort the child, which means we will have less and less children who have Down syndrome. Andrew Solomon didn't mention this specifically, but there has been sort of a holy grail search for the gene footprint that causes homosexuality. And in one case, I think the gay community would like that to be found. I'm getting my mail. So that they could say, see, it's hereditary. I inherited it. This is just who I am. But on the other hand of the double-edged sword is the fact that if heterosexual parents find out that there's a 90% probability that their child is going to be homosexual, does that then lead them to abort the child? And so, with the advances in medical science, with the advances in testing and detection and all those things, this really puts parents in the crosshairs in terms of what do you do and what do you not do. He quoted from an autistic activist. One moment, I'm backing into my garage. An autistic activist, that his viewpoint was, for all these parents who have children who are autistic, for their normal reaction of looking for a cure for autism and hoping that someday their child could be normal, he said, what you're really saying is, I wish I could get rid of my current child and get another one. And it's very easy for me to see how a child who is born with an illness and knows that all their lives, and that is normal, who then finds because of that illness they have an identity, it would be easy for me to understand how a child would react to their parents constantly looking for a cure, because it would feel like the parents are not accepting them. And the conclusion, since I'm already home at this point, the conclusion that Andrew Solomon came to after interviewing all these parents and all the different approaches, and after having children of his own, because of course they got very creative. And so let me just read you real quick how his family ended up. He said that, so my husband is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. I had a close friend from college who had gone through a divorce and wanted to have children. So she and I have a daughter, and mother and daughter live in Texas. And my husband and I have a son who lives with us all the time, of whom I am the biological father, and our surrogate for the pregnancy was Laura, the lesbian mother of Oliver and Lucy in Minneapolis. So obviously, that makes for interesting family gatherings, trying to figure out who's who. He said, and there are people who think that families like mine shouldn't be allowed to exist. And I don't accept subtractive models of love, only additive models. And it's just very, very interesting. But I was happy to hear the conclusion that he came to after all this research. And that the conclusion he came to, the most important conclusion, was love. That no matter what, love. Love your children. Accept your children for who they are. You know, I think it's going to get down to free will that each parent is going to have to decide for themselves what they're going to do to try to fix things or what they're going to do to simply accept what is. But at the base of it, there cannot be fear or guilt or anxiety, you know, or disgust or any of those things driving the actions. Because if those things drive the action, the flesh in that other child is going to feel that. In the child is going to feel that and it's going to react badly to that. But it's really hard to react badly to love. And I was thinking about diversity again this week and just thinking about the amazing diversity that there is in the world. And I don't know where I'm really going to end up on all this, but I do know that it's extraordinarily fascinating to me that when God was dealing with the Israelites who had just come out of 400 years of slavery, and most likely needed a strong hand to help them be successful. God was willing to give them the Ten Commandments, and those subsequently got amplified and adjusted and amended and added to. But when Jesus came and was asked, "What is the greatest commandment?" He didn't quote any of those. He didn't quote any of the Mishnah, is it called? The extra rules and regulations? Not any of them. He came back to a very, very simple thing. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And that's what I'm trying to do. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.